Welcome to the podcast series Remembering Randall. I'm Kerry Carrington, his sister. The guest in today's series is Dr. Yorick Smile, a senior lecturer in history in the School of Humanities, Languages and Social Science at Griffith University. Yorick is an elected fellow of the Royal Historical Society in London, and he's also a member of the Australian Queer Archives Committee. Yorick's research investigates histories of sexuality and sexual violence, and the institutions such as prisons, reformatories and mental asylums that shape these experiences. Today, I ask him about his forthcoming book called Boys, Sex and Crime, to be published by Routledge. But I also ask him to reflect on Randall's story and not of his own research.
Thanks so much, Kerry, for having me along today to talk to you and to your listeners.
It's a delight to have you here, Yorick. Can you just tell me a bit about yourself, where you work and your research interests?
As you noted in your very generous introduction, I'm a historian and a senior lecturer in history at Griffith University, where I teach and research histories of sexuality and gender, war and society, and law and criminal justice. My research recovers unspeakable histories of intimate lives and institutions, so we might better understand the conditions that magnify or erase narratives about erotic identities, genders, and questions of age. My work is concerned with the broad historical structures that have regulated lives and how people have generated their own private and public narratives within and without these frameworks. I'm especially interested in the subjectivities and selfhoods of queer males, as well as the problem of sexual violence between men, between men and boys, and between young males. And as we both know, that problem has been hidden and remains underreported, given that male rape and assault is so often inflected by cultural narratives around homosexuality and beliefs about sexual practices and sexual identities.
So Yorick, you and I both know that the prosecution of institutional assault and sexual assault is unusual. What does your forthcoming book on boys, sex and crime tell us about those sorts of institutional encounters and crimes?
Thanks, Kerry. My book, which I'm hoping will be out next year, all things going to plan, has been a very long 7 years in the making. And as the title suggests, it's a history of young males and criminal and criminalised behaviour in Queensland and the riding of West Yorkshire in England between 1870 and 1930. And one of the key drivers for this comparative research was to investigate and to think about the importance of context. Males, and I've really struggled to do that by including boys and male youths as victims and survivors and complainants in criminal cases, as well as the perpetrators of crime in both male-only offences, as well as those involving females, and cutting across both the institutional and non-institutional setting. Another crucial finding of my research is the powerful legacy of cultural narratives around homosexuality and the belief that complainants in criminal cases had to borrow from the historical terminology, been infected or contaminated by their assaults. And as a consequence, these young males, so experts and others believed, were likely to become perpetrators themselves. Added to this, we have the belief that males over the age of 14 could resist unwanted advances, meaning that those boys who had been subjected to violence were reticent to notify their parents or to alert the authorities, given that it tarnished their masculine prowess and otherwise implied that they had been willing participants. Part of my research has involved a very detailed recovery of the criminal cases to come before the Superior Courts in both the jurisdictions of Queensland and West Yorkshire. And the numbers make it quite clear that there were very few cases of institutional prosecution, despite the many thousands of cases to come before the courts. Now, that's informed by a range of different factors and barriers that prevented and precluded the notification of offences. Certainly, the status of young people in reformatories, orphanages, and mental health facilities, as well as other institutions, are part of the reasoning behind that. Especially the totalising type, and by that I mean those where young males had no access to the outside world. And so we're talking here then about the most vulnerable people in our communities. If we look at some of the historical records, and I'm thinking here of the admissions book to the Westbrook Reformatory, as well as other complementary files, both in other jurisdictions and in West Yorkshire, we see that the so-called crimes of many inmates was neglect. And indeed, neglected children constituted a significant proportion of inmates to institutions of this type because their father had been in prison, or their mother had been drunk or was a prostitute, or both parents had passed away, or perhaps these young people had been rejected by their parents or were seeking other lives and had taken to the streets in order to survive. But who did those young people have to turn to when they were assaulted or abused or raped or tormented or starved or beaten, or some or all of those experiences? And in such a brutalizing environment, recently incarcerated boys quickly learnt to keep their mouth shut, given the consequences of reporting, either from their peers or from the authorities themselves. Myself and colleagues have argued elsewhere that the absence of direct reporting to parents and other guardians, or to public authorities like police, made the notification of these types of crimes more challenging than they already were, and remain, I might point out. But if the archival evidence from the criminal justice system and from institutions remains almost silent on the perpetration of institutional crime, we see by comparison that institutions are quite alive to encounters between boys. We need to remember that these institutions that were so devoid of love and affection and kindness and humanity for those boys who were incarcerated behind institutional walls meant that they also found intimacy and affection with others and their peers, whether that was emotional or psychological or physical. If we examine the punishment registers of boys' institutions, we can see that the authorities had a very clear focus on this type of behaviour between boys. For example, there's a cluster of cases from the Adel Reformatory in West Yorkshire in the 1870s, where a number of inmates were discovered engaging in so-called dirty behaviour in the lavatories. And we see similar types of events captured in Queensland. And when these types of incidents were discovered, they were dealt with very quickly and most usually resolved with corporal punishment. And so much of the testimony we've heard and many inquiries and commissions and reports have highlighted that this so-called justice and physical punishment so often involved sadistic violence, as we well know. So at Westbrook, for example, those boys that were caught together faced up to 20 straps, often delivered in front of other boys and other staff as a form of ritual humiliation and spectacle. And in other places, in New Zealand and other jurisdictions, boys were locked in cells, put on bread and water, starved or isolated from others. What's perhaps not unsurprising is the conviction rate for these so-called offences. Of course, some of these incidents involve violence and rape amongst the boys themselves, but silence in the sources and a failure to often record details of the events means that we can't always be sure of the context. But in any case, out of the 20 confirmed cases involving numerous boys in Westbrook, for example, between 1879 and 1916, every single case resulted in conviction, except one. And two younger boys were cautioned by the visiting justice when he visited for their behaviour. And I think that this is yet another indication of the ways in which the system was stacked against the boys. So the evidence clearly indicates that the status of the boys informed much of the regime of governance and surveillance and oversight that focused on their supposed immorality. And there's much evidence to indicate the type and form of these practices, whether it be regular rounds, lighting to restrict privacy, or the layout and architectural form of institutions, or the layout of beds so that individuals could always be kept under watch, and even in other institutions like boys' public schools, the authorities were known to take the doors off the lavatories so that boys had no privacy and could be kept under surveillance at all times. But even if we account for the fact that several of the cases from Westbrook involved crimes of violence, there are so many other forms of evidence that suggest that these moments of comfort and affection between boys were the activities of greatest concern for the authorities. But the institutional framework was more concerned with the behaviours and morality of its inmates and less concerned with the structures that enabled the abuse of power that had resulted in the horrific crimes that we so often hear about.
Thanks for that explanation, Yorick. I'm just wondering if you could talk a bit more about the importance of context in recovering institutional histories. Can you elaborate on the experiences and the sort of attitudes to young gay men that you've recovered in your work?
That's a great question, Kerry. I think that we have to remember that many of the historical actors that we see in institutional records had the capacity and the potential to make the best of a bad situation. So many of these boys, as I suggested earlier, had already experienced significant hardship. and prejudice. And so these encounters were as much about survival, but also about building friendships, finding companionship, and experiencing human intimacy. I do think it's important again to emphasize the power of context, whether it involves age, experience, personality, or vulnerability. And so, while some may have had the capacity to initiate or to participate in a range of encounters, there were many others who were unable or unwilling to do so and subject to the most horrendous experiences. I also think it's worth noting that even so-called consensual activities or those young males who expressed capacity or even agency were constrained by the institutional setting. So those young boys who recognized their desirability and perhaps exchanged it in that American institution I referred to earlier for tobacco or for other goods, for instance, did so within an institutional regime, while others were only able to steal quick moments at particular times or particular places, but even then, within this context of constrained intimacy, that is, with those inmates who experienced the same conditions. I think one of the challenges with the scholarship that shapes this field is that it so often tends to place inmates in two mutually exclusive camps, so that we have a perspective that frames young people and their experiences as harmful and non-agentic, and another point of view that argues for the agency of young people, including children's ability to engage in exploratory behaviours as well as adolescent expressions of sexuality. But the reality is never that simple. People's lives don't fit neatly into one of two possibilities, and nor do the experiences themselves for that matter. So young people may experience both coercive and engage in consensual behaviours. And I might point out that even mutually agreed encounters always contain a possibility that things are going to turn sour. So I think that this is one of the historical challenges then, to recognise the vast and complex array of human experiences, including those that are violent. Historians of sexuality have, I think, often peacocked the archives, and by that I mean they've worked through the records and selected those criminal cases, when they're working in the criminal justice system, that have highlighted histories of identity and expression and subculture, and have ignored those cases that have involved the perpetration of criminal assault. Now, this practice has been shaped by very valid political concerns around decriminalization and the prejudice of queer individuals, and it's also sought to read against the grain to find other narratives. But I think along with politics, we need to pay attention to people.
Thanks for that explanation, Yorick. Now, queer histories have had much to say about politics, but much less about humans, as you just said, and about personal subjectivities, and including experiences of violence. What contributions can it make to giving voice to the marginalised population of gay men like my brother Randall?
Yes, I think it's about speaking up and speaking out on these types of issues. Queer histories have been vital to the political project by providing crucial background on the factors informing discrimination and prejudice and criminalisation, as well as the resilience and experiences of actors who framed their lives positively within a world that otherwise said they were morally unfit, prone to criminal behaviour and vice, and of course, with particular relevance for the story we're talking about here, mentally unwell. One of the challenges with these political narratives is that they tend to divide the 20th century into a pre-liberation and post-liberation era, with the former unenlightened and challenging, and the latter utopian and easier to navigate. But this is clearly not the case, and many challenges remain. And that's indexed by the continued struggle and fight for civil rights, for recognition, and for the continued advocacy for inclusion. I'd also like to stress the centrality of sex to queer histories, and I'm speaking here about sex between males. That's been really one of the key drivers of the political agenda and the push for decriminalisation. And this has been replicated in the historiography. That's not surprising, of course, given that behaviours between males remained criminal for much of the 20th century. But it's that lumping together of consensual and mutually affective behaviours and those crimes of violence and assault that pose problems for researchers and for individuals in both of those camps that I spoke about earlier. So those men who have reconciled their identities have to struggle with the dominant narratives which remain remarkably persistent even today, which say that they are abusers or predators or have a predilection for young people. And on the other hand, we have the victims and the survivors and the complainants of sexual assault who need to reconcile their own identity or feel they need to reconcile their own identity and sexuality with the crimes that they have experienced. Now, the origins of that cultural narrative can be traced back to at least the 1920s, and I think that it really highlights the importance and power of history to the types of discussions that we're having here, Kerry. So in the post-war era, psychological and psychiatric thinking divided queer men into two complementary categories of homosexuality. The first was the invert, or the congenital homosexual, and these were men who were genuinely afflicted, in inverted commas, by their natural attraction to those of the opposite sex. These feelings and desires were accompanied, at least as far as psychologists were concerned, with affected dispositions and effeminate behaviours. The other category of homosexual was the pervert. Now, unlike the invert, perverts had acquired their behaviours by learning their so-called deviant practices and their yearning for other men by associating with or consorting with the wrong crowd, and that included the criminal classes. As the 20th century unfolded, this distinction became important to a variety of institutions broadly conceived. That included the courts, to the prisons and the reformatories, certainly in the 30s and 40s, as well as the Defence Forces. The military has actually formed part of this study, and I've been drawing on to think critically about the importance of sex to validating the self, both for individuals and the forces, and to place those recollections and collective memories within the centrality of sex, and positive sex at that, to the gay political project, which may have foreclosed other possibilities and interpretations, is that being a victim or a survivor or a complainant of sexual assault or being queer is not mutually exclusive. Don't get me wrong, I'm all for sex and positive sex at that, but unfortunately, that's not the lived experience for everyone.
Well, Yorick, you know my brother Randall's story. I'm especially interested in how institutions like prisons and mental hospitals and lock wards, like where my brother was victimised as a male homosexual and he was repeatedly raped as the youngest in Pierce House in Walston Park. Why are these institutions never held to account? Why do you think that might be the case?
I think part of the answer, Kerry, has to do with those institutional structures we've been speaking about today, and those barriers to reporting. And that applies to prisoners and to individuals in mental health facilities, like your brother, as well as many other settings. So the imbalance of power structures and power relations between guards and prisoners, or doctors and nurses and patients, makes it difficult to seek redress for wrongdoing when cases are reported in the first place. And that's often informed and inflected by a fear of retribution or other consequences. And this equally applies to offences between inmates. Given the cultures of silence and violence, which mean that you keep your mouth shut. You and I both know what happens to narcs on the inside. I think we can add to these issues concerns about institutional reputation, the structures that prevent reporting, and the status of those who attempt to report these crimes. And again, we're talking here about vulnerable individuals, so that boys are considered to be moral dirt. Prisoners are criminal, and so not worthy of investigation or follow through. And the mentally ill are deluded or detached from reality. So all of these different factors erode the respectability and the legitimacy of these complaints. As you know, Kerry, Randall's story has affected me deeply, and it's a very powerful and emotional narrative. And again, I think this comes back to something we were discussing earlier, and that's the fact that institutions have known for a long time about the risks of mixing inmates or patients well back into the 19th century. The authorities recognised the risks and dangers of placing older and younger boys together, and even the need to separate different types of offenders, so non-violent offenders from violent offenders. But I might also note that this applied to same-sex crime and the belief that homosexual men needed to be removed from other inmates to prevent so-called infection on institutional populations, most notably in prisons, although we also see it in boys' institutions, certainly from the 1940s on. I find it difficult to reconcile Randall's experience given what was known, and yet the recent Royal Commission into Institutional Responses to Child Sexual Abuse was not the first inquiry into this type of problem, and it won't be the last, And so when I hear about Randall and his experience and the way that it has affected others, it highlights for me the absolute disregard for the welfare and care of our most vulnerable, as well as the systemic failures to address structural factors that enable and continue to enable the perpetration of these types of tragedies. That echoes the earlier history that we've been talking about, Kerry, and the fact that it's the most vulnerable, our most prejudiced members of community who are subject to state surveillance and state intervention. And they're the ones left to endure these conditions. It's not the privileged, well-off, white middle classes. We haven't had a Royal Commission into that, but we have continuous inquiries and reports and investigations into the deaths in custody of First Nations people. We have Royal Commissions into the assault of children. We have a range of other inquiries into the failure of state apparatus to protect and care for young people. Those observations, Kerry, I think speak to the power of storytelling and why it's so important to inform and educate the public, not just to enable others to practice and engage with their own past and to recover their own histories. But Randall's story, which I've said so many times, is so powerful and so deeply personal to you, and which has really touched me in a very personal way. And as I've said on numerous occasions, I've been privileged and honored to speak to you on this story. And I think it really points to the importance of the work that needs to be done here. There are so many difficulties with the evidence, but the very personal story that you're sharing with me and sharing with all of us and sharing with listeners points to all of the problems, socially, intellectually, and historically, that demand further public attention and discussion, scholarly research.
Yorick, I've got another question for you. There's a distinct lack of transparency about the systemic abuses and crimes that occurred in prisons and mental hospitals and places like Walton Park Mental Hospital, and which include, for example, the treatment of my brother Randall and many others like him, who were given chemical restraints, who were bashed, who were raped, who I believe were experimented upon, some of them with all sorts of psychotropic drugs and shock treatment, and given shock treatment without anaesthetic. What do you think should be done now to address these historical atrocities and the fact that the evidence we need to unearth them, that's the state archives and the medical records and the records of Wollstone Park, are all hidden and protected by legislation for 100 years?
It's a really tricky question, Kerry. And as you know, I've been dealing with archival records and seeking access to closed materials for a very long time. Much of my work involves criminal justice records, so court transcripts, criminal depositions, but also policy files, as well as institutional records of reformatories and prisons. Most of my experiences have been positive, and many agencies have enabled access to sensitive material. But those decisions are always informed by a balancing act between the rights of individuals and the access to institutional records. I think a big challenge in this particular instance is the type of material and the way in which the relationship and the confidentiality of practitioner and patient continues in perpetuity. But I don't think that that says we shouldn't be able to access those institutional records that speak to broader practices and structures, those very things that we've been discussing today. And in your brother's case, you and I and all of your listeners to this podcast already know that he was there. So denying access to those records in this particular instance doesn't protect anyone's anonymity. I also want to point out that it comes down to the context and the intent and purpose of the research endeavour. The last time I checked, people weren't popping into the archives to read personal and private and highly sensitive medical records for an afternoon of reading pleasure. Those that undertake this task do so for intellectual reasons, and they're often seeking, even when they are seeking to recover very personal stories, to ask bigger questions about those complex social problems. I also want to point out that there's a legacy of providing access to challenging records that contain sensitive information, and I think it's quite achievable. Universities have very strict ethics in place for scholarly researchers, and individuals also bring with them their own sense of ethics and obligation. I don't think, as so much of the discussion has been today, it's as simple as one or the other. Nonetheless, I'm not unaware of the irony that we are currently restricting institutional records on the premise of protecting individuals, and yet these are the very places, the very sites, the very institutions that inflicted harm and trauma and violence and enabled criminal activities. And by the time that you and I can access these records, you'll be dead, I'll be dead. Those with the cultural knowledge of those institutions will also be long gone.
So, Yorick, do you think I'm going to find any of the evidence I'm looking for in those records in any case about the abuse of my brother in Wollaston Park?
And so, again, I think that the type of work you're doing here in speaking up and speaking out and pointing to the context of both place and people, this type of work and this type of recovery is so vitally important to not only remembering Randall, but to redressing the injustices that he experienced and to preventing them from happening again. Those horrendous experiences, Kerry, also speak to the limits of the evidence. And I think there's a large gap between policy and practice, and all of that horrific conduct that you've just explained probably not going to match up to the written record, if it's been recorded at all. So again, I think that this really points to the importance of recovering these stories through other means, to capturing those memories and those experiences through oral testimony and other forms of cultural evidence that you have been seeking to recover.
You've been listening to the podcast series Remembering Randall. I'm Kerry Carrington and his sister.